Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 129, featuring a good friend and former boss of mine, Jay Barton, over at Digital Domain. He's a visual effects supervisor over there and really, really fun to be around. Really great. He recently came off of The Fate of the Furious, which is the last Fast and Furious franchise movie, number 8. Which, as many of you probably know, did very, very well in the box office. Did an enormous amount of work on it. And his talent, or his knowledge, or his expertise in cars probably had a lot to do with its success in it. He does know a whole lot about cars, and we talk about that a lot on the podcast because it's a big part of where he came from. And he's a really cool and interesting guy. I really love hanging out with Jay. He's a really nice guy. Besides that, there's a couple of announcements you need to make. Of course, SIGGRAPH is coming up pretty soon. So for those of you planning to go to SIGGRAPH, we don't have everything completely finalized yet because we've got so much going on. We want to make sure all of our ducks are in a row. But we're going to plan to have another great 2 days of V-Ray Days presentations. The speakers are going to be fantastic this year. We will announce them soon, I'm sure. So just keep an eye on it. Go to chaosgroup.com and check it out. Look for news on that. Of course, you can always check it out on our social networks, which a lot of followers are on that. So you will be sure to see what's going on there. Hopefully, I will see you at SIGGRAPH. And I am planning to do another live podcast over there. So that will be a lot of fun. So keep an eye on that as well. If you guys love the podcast, you will probably enjoy seeing it live. Let me see. What else is going on? Oh, yes. We have officially put out V-Ray 3.6 for 3D Studio Max or 3DS Max. I still have to say 3D Studio Max. Boy, I am old school. Anyway, 3.6 is out. And, of course, one of the big hot topics that everyone seems to be talking about is our hybrid rendering. And if you don't know what hybrid rendering is, go to labs.chaosgroup.com and check out the blog post I wrote about it. It's pretty, pretty cool stuff. It basically allows you to render on CPUs and GPUs at the same time. La! Amazing. Hybrid. And I think that's about it. So with that being said, please enjoy this great podcast with Jay Barton. Thanks a lot, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I was just in China. I went to Beijing to see the DD offices.
We have DD offices in Beijing now?
Yeah, and Shanghai.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, Hong Kong, they're business offices. They're not artists. We have artists in Beijing and in Shanghai. Shanghai is mostly a commercial division for Asia. And Beijing is currently working on, they've got like 2,000 minutes of animation due for like a mini series. You know how they do all their Monkey King things, right? So they've got a new Monkey King miniseries.
Okay.
And it's an incredible amount of work.
Right.
And then they're also planning to be doing feature film work.
Right.
For the local market and hopefully also some, you know, overflow for us. You know, kind of how we started originally using Vancouver for rebates.
Right.
Hopefully we're going to be using them for the cheaper workforce. Mm-hmm. And then we're also opening up a rather large studio in India.
Wow.
That's going to be doing the bulk of the...
Can we mention it? Because I've already started recording, but I can cut this out. Can we mention any of that?
Yeah. I assume so.
Okay.
I assume so. Yeah. So I know we're working
on... So you're going to get a Beijing, Shanghai, and another office in India.
Yeah. So the two that are currently going in China are companies that we purchased. We purchased quite a while ago, so they were already up and running.
Okay.
And they're now Digital Domain branded, and we're working with them, getting them up on the same networks and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I got a chance to go over there and tour the facilities and give some talks, and they signed me up at a university, and I gave a talk, a presentation at a university, which was actually really fun. But it was a well-documented trip. Like, They literally videoed the plane that I was on as it was landing.
Really?
Yeah. And I just got this, you know, 3 minute, 4 minute video or whatever, you know,
of your trip
distilled down. Every waking second, they have me like eating breakfast. They have me going to the Great Wall.
This is like a reality show of you in China.
It is like a reality show of me. All
right, wait, you ever see those Idiot Abroad? Not that I'm saying that's what you are. You never see those shows?
Oh, that's it. Good day, sir.
Well, I love it. I love it. It's really cool. I would love to see that. Can we share that? Is it public?
It's not. It does have some of my presentations in it.
Right.
They have some work stuff, and some other stuff.
Yeah.
But come by. I'll show it to you. It's fun.
Okay. Yeah. I'd love to see it.
It's fun.
Well, that's fun. That's fun. I love it. Okay. So you're in China. You're helping that stuff kind of get off the ground a little bit and showing them a little bit about, you know, the digital domain history. I'm sure you're telling them about that.
It's a little bit more about the digital domain history. I took examples of, you know, I took our regular reel, which I could speak to, but then I took reels about projects that I'd worked on, including commercial reels, a couple of commercials that won VES awards for best effects in a commercial. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just kind of told them stories. As you know, I've been at Digital Domain for 18 and a half years.
Yes, you have.
Well, I'm not exactly sure if it's 18 and a half years, but let's just agree that however long it's been, it's too long.
You could vote.
No. Yeah, exactly. My first card that I got, my first ID card could vote. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's old enough.
Yep.
But the guy on the picture looks like he could serve, actually.
Right.
Me, not so much.
Right, right, right.
But yeah, no, it was really cool. It's part of our one company initiative.
Uh-huh.
You know, I went over there to forge relationships, make sure I know who I'm talking to when stuff comes out or they need help or we need help and we're sending work over.
So what's the size of the workforce, do you say? If you combine the Shanghai, Beijing, and you said maybe something in Hong Kong too, right?
Well, there's a business office.
The business office in Hong Kong. Okay, so if you combine anything that's going on in that area, in India and in China and Hong Kong, how much are you talking about in terms of workforce size that you're seeing in that area?
That's a really good question. I'm sure Tiffany could get back to you, and you could splice in a little thing. Actually, he was talking out of his butt, and it's really X number of people, and that comes in right here.
Right.
But what I want to say, I saw probably 100 people in the Beijing office.
Uh-huh.
I'm guessing the Shanghai office is a little smaller, but they just moved into new facilities that are very nice.
Right.
I mean, very nice in Beijing. Mm-hmm. And they're working on the facility in Shanghai. They have a slide from the fourth floor down to the third floor. You walk up to the railing and it's a curly slide that you can go down. And they were even talking about possibly putting in a fireman's pole.
Nice.
Which would be fun as well. Of course, I did the slide. The slide was awesome.
Yeah.
I would totally do that.
That's awesome. Oh, well, that's really cool. I'm glad. And so, you know, it's interesting because obviously I think for especially people in the West, we don't necessarily get as exposed to some of the filmmaking that's going on in the East, right? And I just flew back from Venice, and I was on a Lufthansa flight, and they had four or five movies that were, you know, because they have like 100 movies on the plane or whatever, right? They had four or five movies that were Chinese movies that looked like very high production value movies, right? And I'm like, I've never even heard of this movie. And of course, it's only offered in Chinese, no subtitles. So this is obviously for the Chinese market that happens to be on a Lufthansa flight. Mm-hmm. But I was like, there is a lot of really big movies being done in China right now, right? This is obviously there's an audience there, right?
Oh, it's a huge audience. A huge audience. I mean, not to bring it back around to me, but look at Fast and Furious 8.
Exactly. I was just about to say that.
You know, I don't even know how many, you know, millions of dollars it's done in the U.S., but it's done
300 million in China.
300 million in China. Like, I'm surprised it didn't do a billion in China all by itself.
Yeah.
Like they have such a voracious appetite.
Yeah.
For
they have a lot of people.
Big blockbusters.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of people. I mean, they have, you know, a huge number of theaters.
Right.
They have a lot of people, and everybody's hungry for content over there.
Right.
And they do their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But their own stuff, you know, it is a different market. There's a different tolerance for, you know, how much time they're going to put in it, how much money they're going to pay for it. You know, they're going to do, you know, 100 movies, you know, for what we do one movie for in the States. Which is, it's kind of funny because everywhere I went and no matter who I talked to, one of the questions was, you know, given the time and budgets that we have working on projects in China, what can we do to approach the level of work in the US or even get a piece of the work in the US?
Right.
And my answer was, if I knew how to do that, I'd bring that back to the US and I'd undercut all my competitors. I mean, there's no magic bullet for that kind of stuff. But boy, they're searching for one.
But do you think that there is, obviously, like I said, the higher production value that's going on there. But do you think that there's actually something that we are doing in the United States that is overkill, that they could cut out or something? Or do you think that this is just a level that we expect? I mean, you and I worked at Digital Domain, you still work at Digital Domain. We are notorious for trying to make sure that we deliver the highest possible quality. So we'll spend a lot of time on the last 1 or 2% making sure that everything's looking correct, right? And I don't really know of that many facilities that do what we call gauntleting, right? Mm-hmm. Where we basically take a shot and make sure it's perfect before it goes out for us. Like, we can see not a single pixel left behind, right? And I don't know if that's in the budget in China, probably.
Well, it's not only just the finishing of it, it's the engineering at the beginning. You know what I mean? Like a Digital Domain, we always talk about the fact that we internally feel that we over-engineer everything. Mm-hmm. We make it more complex than it needs to be. And then it's going to be more expensive by making it more complex. And that makes it harder for us to compete in the open market. The flip side of that is when you get to the end of a project, especially a project that's got a lot of shots, and you've engineered something that works really well, and you're spitting out hundreds of finals a week.
Right.
You know, so it's a catch-22. I don't know what, you know, certainly for bidding, that was something that we had in commercials all the time. You know, well, Ed Ulbrich was like, you know, how can X company or Y company or whatever, they're undercutting us by 30%. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, clearly the director's not telling them a different project than he's telling us.
Right.
You know, what's allowing them to do it? You're overthinking it. You're over-engineering it. But when we get them and when we do them, you know, they look fantastic. You know, it's beyond reproach. So, you know, what's the middle ground there? I don't know.
So let's talk about this, because you're also one of those great people that was at Digital Domain in a commercial side, heavily in the commercial side, and then now you're heavily in the feature side now and working on big movies like, you know, Fast and Furious, right? So there was something where, like in commercials, where you just got it done no matter what. You didn't engineer a bunch, right? You have a skeleton pipeline that's efficient and general enough to do the job, and you fill in the gaps with generalists to take care of all the other problems, right? Mm-hmm. But then when you're working on a feature film where you got to do 500, 600, 1,000 shots, whatever it is, you engineer that big thing, right?
Well, there's an economy of scale to do so. You know what I mean? We delivered roughly 800 shots on Fate of the Furious.
Right.
I think we delivered more than that originally, but the edits kept going in flux.
Sure.
And they cut it, and I think it was slightly less than that that made the final film. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's an economy of scale to do that. You know, you're going to have hundreds of a certain type of shot. You're going to engineer, you know, Dom's vehicle for a wide variety of shots and how much we're going to see of this and how much we're going to see of that. Mm-hmm. A car commercial was 20 shots, 30 shots. You know, half of them are one-offs.
If it's I used to joke about it. If it's a 30-second commercial and it's 24 frames a second, it's 720 frames, right? That's it. So you just have to deliver 720 frames of a commercial and not worry about anything else. Mm-hmm. But this is like a lot of stuff, right? So yeah, so you do. You know that car extraordinarily intimately, right? Mm-hmm. You know everything you can do for that shot, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
So I find that fascinating, just sort of going through those that process of, you know, and you always have that one shot that is your development shot. that goes on and on and on and on and on.
The first shot you start and the last shot that's finished.
Isn't that funny?
Almost always.
Almost always, right? Almost always. I always joke about it. Like when I was on Tron, I worked on LB-1203, and
Do you want that carved on your tombstone? I'm just curious. You remember it so well, and it's been, you know, what, 6 years ago?
I think I worked on it 6 or 9 months. I worked on that thing. But it was one shot, I think 124 versions of lighting. That's ridiculous to think about it. But if it wasn't for that shot, none of the rest of the sequence would have gotten done, right? So it was a big thing. But it was kind of cool, I mean, to do those things and sort of see that scale, because once those things start popping out, then you're like, yeah, this is, the system's working, right? The machine's working.
The machine works.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad Nikos isn't here, because Nikos would have been a really good person, because he's one of the guys who's basically the muscle behind the machine, right? In a lot of ways, the way he sort of pushes those shots, making sure that everything's kind of moving along and greased. And you how many shows have you done with Nikos now?
Many. I mean, certainly we did quite a few commercials together back in the day. And
he's also an old school DD guy too, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Trying to think of a movie that I've worked on that didn't have Nikos at one point. I think there were some that started, but you know, he always helped out at some point.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's a huge resource that I certainly rely on to do certain aspects of the production. As a digital effects supervisor and a visual effects supervisor, we've worked together, you know, on lots of projects.
I think X-Men was one of the first big feature films that you guys were working on together. Am I correct about
yes.
that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and then I worked with you and Nikos on 27 Ronin.
47.
47.
Ronin. Don't cut it short by 20. You know.
47 Ronin. and then you guys did I mean, obviously you did Furious 7 together and a bunch of other things.
Yeah, we did Cat 6. We called it Cat 6, Into the Storm.
Into the Storm, that's right.
And then we did that, oh my gosh, one of the most fun times I've ever had working on a feature film, Rock of Ages, with Tom Cruise.
I was on that too, that's right. I forgot, that was a lot of fun.
Oh, so much fun.
So much fun. Rock of Ages, it was cool because I think it was sort of like a, we're just going to get started on 47 Ronin, and they basically had a little bit, you know, we had to finish up Rock of Ages. The director on that was so much fun.
Oh, so much fun.
Yeah.
So
a musical. This is something we don't get to do very often.
No, it's not. A musical comedy.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't remember it that well clearly. I remember we had monthlies one night.
Uh-huh.
And we came in, and this is right when we were instituting that the visual effects supervisor or DFX or whoever would actually stand up in front and give a little introduction to what they were going to see.
Before we get too far, we should let people know what monthlies is, right? What monthlies is basically every month we would show all the different projects going on as a short thing. And so we make a little, like a mini demo reel of each one, only internal, right?
Only internal,
right.
Beer and popcorn usually,
yep.
Hang out, two showings.
Yep.
And, you know, it was a little introduction reel. You might see just some previs of something that was just starting.
Whatever was
or
in progress.
A final reel of something that just finished. And, you know, and monthlies, still called monthlies, even though we have them, you know, every maybe 4 months now.
Right.
It's just not a priority with everything that's going on. It's actually, it's really hard to book screening room time with all the projects we have going on. But yeah, monthlies at that time. And I remember all the other projects that we had in-house at that time were like super serious, you know what I mean? They were just like, they were just like, oh my God, I want to cut my own wrist. You know what I mean? I don't remember, you know, what it was, but you know, might have been Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or you know what I mean? There's definitely a Fincher thing was going on, whatever. And after watching all these really heavy ones, I'm like, all right, our next one, very serious, very, very heavy story, very dark about Tom Cruise as a rock and roll actor.
Yep.
You know, and all of a sudden it comes on all these, you know, crazy 80s songs. And you know, I felt like Rip Taylor running in, throwing confetti in the air.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was really cool. All right, so let's dig deep into Jay. How you said you've been at Digital Domain 18 years. Is that when you first started in visual effects?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Well, in entertainment, in visual effects.
Okay, what were you doing before that?
I worked in a law firm doing computer animation for courtroom presentations.
Really?
Yeah.
You know who at Digital Domain has that in common with you?
No.
Steve Prigg.
Oh, really?
Yes. So he worked on the O.J. Simpson case.
Oh, no way.
Yes.
Who knew?
And he did a podcast with him, or like one of my first podcasts, and he was talking about how he did like an animation of some guy running.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and then but he made him like, because it's just some guy running, right? Mm-hmm. And trying to see if he can get from this point and the amount of time for whatever, right? And so they made, you know, he made him black. And then they're like, no, you can't make him black. And it's like, what color do you want me to make? And so they make him blue or something. Like, so it completely did not make any difference. It was really funny to hear those stories.
But I'd make him red and just because he's covered in blood. Who knows what's underneath.
That's funny. That's really funny. So you did courtroom stuff, right?
Yeah, I did.
All Lightwave, I'm assuming.
I did, yeah, this back in the Lightwave days.
Yeah.
And it was I worked for multiple law firms, but I had a office in a law firm in Century City. I had like the corner office, looked out over Beverly Hills.
Nice.
And I did a project for this particular lawyer, and he liked it so much, and he knew this was going to be, you know, a huge thing. And he's like, I want you to be able to work for everybody, anybody that wants you, but I'll give you an office. I'll build you a great computer. I want you to do it all in my office so that when people come in, I can go and look at the other services we offer and come in and show them this high-end stuff.
Nice.
And this great office. It was amazing. But most of the work that I did back then was environmental court cases. You know,
it going to the water or something?
Right, yeah. Right. You know, a mountain that had been strip mined for many years,
right.
And the water was leaking into the exposed shafts and then coming out as basically rust, killing all the fish.
Right,
it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to pay to clean it up? But nobody really understands what's there, so they hire scientists and geologists that give expert testimony, and they make books. You know, those books are, you know, 6-8 inches thick of binders, and they go into court, and they, you know, all right, starting off where we left off at page 1,733,
right.
The waste rock pile number 12, which is 3/4 mile northeast of hematite rock pile number 7, consists of...
Right, so you make an animation to explain it.
Yeah, so I make an animation and cut a mountain in half and show how it was strip mined and helicopter fly through and then stop at key points and fly out real photos of the thing so that people can kind of understand what's going on and what's there. And I was never in the courtroom when these things happen.
Sure.
There were some things that I did for, you know, like city hall presentations and things like that, whatever the law firms would come up with. But I was never in the courtrooms when these happened, but I had heard stories that it was, you know, like Matlock law, you know what I mean? It's like you get somebody, you know, they'd show something. As soon as you look at a video, that's a real thing. I mean, someone can sit there and talk about it, you know, whatever, I don't know what it is, but you dumb it down to a third grade level and you make a video about it and somebody sees it and they stand up and scream, I object, you know what I mean? Like, wow, it is. I'd hear the funniest stories.
Yeah. Well, I think that videos are just so like their narrative, right? And it's very linear and you can follow it very easily no matter what. So, yeah. That's great. How long did you do that for?
Probably 3 years.
Okay.
I want to say.
That's a good amount.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and then suddenly you got a job at DD. How did that happen?
Yeah. I'll start with getting in because there's a little bit of a backstory behind that.
Yeah.
I went to Art Center for car design.
Oh, right.
Right.
Like with Eric and those guys.
Yeah. I didn't know Eric in school. We were a couple of semesters apart.
Right.
But we had a lot of the same friends.
Yep.
And then we met later on as I was learning computer animation and trying to get in.
Got it.
Through a completely unrelated thing.
Uh-huh.
We were on a tournament paintball team. We traveled the the western half of the United States playing paintball for cash and prizes.
Professionally.
Have gun, will travel. And and I was just trying to break into 3D, and he was the first person to tell me about Lightwave and the Amiga video toasters, and he was working on
Eric was?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was working on Sequest at the time.
Yes.
Amblin Imaging.
Yes. You know, he used to be a sales rep for SGI, I think.
That's funny enough. So that's, since we're getting into the whole story, that's, I saw him put on a Sequest jacket, and I was trying to get into 3D at the time, and I'm going to go talk to this guy. He's got a Sequest jacket on, and I kept asking, well, how did you get into it? How did you get into it? And I kept getting these, you know, well, I got hired by Amblin because I was a rep for SGI, and they hired me because I was showing them the system, and I was doing SGI for them. Well, how'd you get that job? Well, blah, 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 you know, and it finally traced it back to, oh, I went to Art Center for car design. I was like, I went to Art Center for car design, and all of a sudden I wasn't, you know, 99% of the clueless people out there that look at, you know, computer animation on a screen and go, ooh, that looks cool. I want to do that. You know,
Like,
that, you know, I had a similar background and would understand the same path.
Conversation changes.
It did.
Yeah.
It did. It very much did. So we had a mutual friend that worked at the Southern California Gas Company, and they were working on a project that they were doing a documentation for and sales tool, CD-ROM, and they needed some animated cutscenes.
Okay.
And he goes, oh, I know a guy can do that, meaning Eric. And Eric couldn't. He was under contract and he was too busy at the time. And he said, yeah, you know, talk to Jay. He's been doing a lot of that kind of stuff. So I did that job for this guy who was also at the time working on a patent with a lawyer. And so when he showed my animation to his patent lawyer, that lawyer goes, we've got this big environmental case that nobody can understand. Can he do mountains and scientific stuff? And they called me and asked, and I lied and said, of course I can do that.
Yes.
You know, like we all did back in those days.
Sure.
Because every time you did something.
Because no one actually knows how to do that.
No one knew that stuff. Every time you did it, it was the first time it was ever being done, you know, or as you know, far as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that got me in with the lawyers, and I had a great time for, you know, for a few years working with them. But that type of work is basically previs.
Yeah.
You're doing previs to get the point across. And once the point is across, they go, great, thank you very much. Here's, you know, next project. And you're like, no, this is just the previs. Now I was going to start making it look good. And they're like, well, we don't care if it looks good. You know, move on to the next project. It gets the point across. I can show this to a jury.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at the point where I wanted to
make
things look good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I want to do that. And I was doing my own projects, and I had modeled my own CG cars and done some car things because I'm always been a car guy, you know, my whole life, crazy car guy.
We can talk about your Porsche racing.
And I got a call from Eric, and he was working on what was the project? Supernova. They had just started Supernova.
So he had gone to DD at this point.
He was at DD at this point, and
Supernova was the first project after Titanic, I think.
I believe so.
Yeah,
I believe so. And they and he had done some car commercials at DD at that time, very early on. And they got in a two car commercials. It was Pontiac Metal City and Metal Desert.
Okay.
And they were, as far as I know, the first like 100% environment. Everything, all CG car commercials. And one was a silver four-door Pontiac Grand Am driving through an all-metal city. So it's, you know, driving over a bridge over a Mercury river and splashing through mercury puddles on metal patchwork roads and
very
all the buildings.
Detroit.
Yeah, it's very, very Detroit. And the second one was a black two-door driving through like a golden desert that was all metal. So, you know, it was
bling.
Exactly. Very much so. So, you know, the big giant tumbleweeds going through frame that were made out of barbed wire,
Nice.
And cacti that just looked like wind blown metal sculptures in the desert. And it was really pretty neat.
Yeah.
But they didn't have anybody, other than Eric that had a lot of car experience at that time. A couple people had a little bit of car experience.
But he was on Supernova.
And he was on Supernova.
Got it.
And he basically called me up and said, you know cars. You know, you know what it takes to make cars look good by going through Art Center. You know what I mean?
But you had never done any kind of
that kind of stuff.
But you were almost in the same boat as before, right? Because you never had actually done some commercial of that scale before, right?
No, none of that stuff. None of that stuff.
Awesome.
And he said, it's coming up. They're bidding on it right now. If it lands, they need somebody. make something. And I made a little part of my demo reel. I made a chrome armadillo. And he was set up with one of the Whirly plugins so that you could roll him into a ball with all the metal plates and the, you know, whatever. And I rolled him all up in a ball and I rolled him into frame and he flopped over and opened up and legs poked out and his head poked out and he looked around and kind of ran, scampered off. And they actually used it in the commercial. They hired me and they used it in the commercial.
Oh, so cool.
And they initially, someone else was going to do the car body. We had Viewpoint at the time. They were on our stages and they had the cars and they were all taped up and they're digitizing them with the big giant digitizing arm like they used to do back in the day. And we started getting information from that. And I was doing the undercarriages. I was doing the bottom sides of the cars
because
I, you know, also work on cars and wrench on cars. And, you know, like you mentioned, I built a race car. And so I was making the suspension and setting it up so that it would, you know, animate and work and springs and all that kind of stuff. Because there were shots in both spots that were close-ups on the suspension moving as it went over uneven terrain. And I started working on that and it was all going pretty well. And I remember the day the CG soup on that came over and he's like, Topley, undercarriage is looking awfully good. I think maybe you should just, you know, work your way out from the bottom of the car. And like someone else would be working from the top down and I'd start at the bottom and we'd meet. So obviously I got to do both cars for the spots and then, you know, a bunch of shots in each spot. And it was, oh my God, it was an amazing, amazing learning experience.
Little story.
So doing the type of work that I'd been doing, which was everything in camera, you know, you rendered it all together. It was previs for lack of a better, better understanding for the law work. Very early on, I was throwing everything in my shots and I was trying to make them look good. And the first few weeks of working shots, that's what everybody's doing. Everybody's doing your own animation, or maybe you're inheriting a previous scene that's got some animation done and you're filling it up with assets because everybody's been making assets and you're starting to light it and you're starting to make it look good. And, you know, I remember from day one, we go into dailies and I'd show my shots and people are like, hey, wow, who is this guy? Hey, this stuff looks pretty good. Boy, I was feeling pretty good, you know? And so then, you know, a week or so in or whatever, 2 weeks, they go, okay, great, guys. So let's split up your scenes and start rendering nuke elements and let's start looking at nuke comps.
Right.
What the hell is nuke?
What?
You know what I mean? Like I used a little bit of After Effects in my early job and it was usually for adding titles or if I was under the gun and I couldn't render two things together because they were so big, I would render them separately and comp them with alpha channels. And I was like, what the hell do I do? So I render everything, try and figure out how to render it separately and do a bunch of A over Bs. And
probably hardly ever used an alpha channel.
Exactly. And the next day I come in and my A over B nuke comp looks just like my full render from the day before. And everybody else, lens flares and glows and all, I mean, just, but I, what the hell? I thought my stuff was just a little better than every, all of a sudden now my stuff was on the floor and theirs was soaring. And I was just, oh, where have you been all my life? This is amazing. And learning how to take advantage of Nuke to take something that I couldn't get it to look like I wanted it in 3D or in lighting or whatever, and turned it into something, you know, in comp. Like it was that those 3 months were the biggest education for me in workflow and how to do that kind of stuff. And, you know, how to take something from previs to, you know, something's going to air on national, you know, television, whatever it is. And I'd taken a 3 month leave of absence from my job to come in and do that, that little project. And that turned into 18 and a half years.
Well, that's pretty, it's pretty awesome. I mean, I think, you know, DD obviously, especially in the commercial side, and all the way up to what you're doing now when you're doing Fated to Furious, has a long history in automotive stuff, right? And I know this, I never actually worked on any car commercials at DD or anything, but I was, you know, sort of the head of 3D at Sway Studio back when that was around. And so there was some excellent, excellent car stuff coming out of there. But DD was the high watermark, right? That was how the best car stuff was coming out of Digital Domain at that time, when car commercials were big in CG. I don't think they're as big now in CG as they used to be, but they're just such a high caliber that, like, if we can get as close as possible to looking as good as DD, then we're doing fantastic. So there's a lot of amazing car. And I think a lot of it comes also from knowledge of how to make a car look good, right? Yeah. And like people like you and Eric that really sort of have that education and know about that stuff. It's fascinating. I mean, just like you were talking about the scanning of the cars, like how you get the good guys, know how to scan a car properly. You know, it's not just always laser scanning. It was plot scanning. Actually, some of the best plot scanners. I forgot the name of the company we used to use. They're out of Utah, but I don't think they're a Viewpoint.
I'm not sure. I think they were an offshoot, or they started by people that used to work at Viewpoint left. Or there was
Because I remember Eric telling me
some cross-pollination in there.
Eric was telling me about a group that he used, and it was the same so many years ago, but it was the same year, same guys, and they were really good. And then you have to make the headlights look really good, because that's actually one of the most important part of the car and in terms of how it looks. So yeah, car stuff was great. So how much of that got applied to what you did on Fate of the Furious?
There's certainly a lot of experience that I have just in looking at cars and looking at CG cars and understanding, why a molded surface versus a stamped metal surface would have a certain radius that it does, or that kind of stuff that I think most people, they don't know, or they don't, they don't think about. The standard thing is you get a model in and you look at the topology of whatever the model is, and you rebuild it however you would normally rebuild it, and you look at it and go, hey, look, this looks pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm the jerk that comes in after somebody's worked for, weeks on something, mm-hmm. and then I go, actually, this has a support structure underneath here that would cause the metal to do a blah, 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 blah. That's mm-hmm. looking at me like, really? Somebody will mm-hmm. notice that? And somebody will notice it. Or they won't notice that, but they'll look at it and they go, why does it look like a toy car? Why does it look like a plastic car?
And
why does it,
You bring up an excellent point, because I think cars are, we're extraordinarily familiar to cars. Mm-hmm. And if they don't move right, they don't do something right. It's like the Uncanny Valley problem, right?
It's very much like Uncanny Valley.
Because we see cars every day, and we see them driving every day. Now, of course, Fate of Furious had a lot of practical cars, crazy stunts that they mm-hmm. did, right? So mm-hmm. they sort of, some of it is CG and some of it is practical, which is a testament, I think, because that means that the CG was so good that you can't tell which ones are which, right?
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. It's funny. There's a lot of, I don't know. Certainly there are people on my team that, they see talk about, how much of it is real, and it's a franchise that, mm-hmm. that plays off on the fact that it is all real. They do a tremendous amount of stuff real. They mm-hmm. do the most amazing stunts, explosions, rigs and setups and all this stuff. I mean, it really is spectacular. I mean, I could go on and on and on for, mm-hmm. for hours about some of the setups that I've, been involved in or been, on location when they went off. And you just can't believe that this stuff works the way that it works.
Sure.
And a large amount of it shows up on screen very much like it's been planned, and mm-hmm. we just go in and do a little cleanup because we have to get rid of some rigging or a car flipper that's bolted to the bottom that makes the car go. But there's also a lot of stuff where, the cars are doing all these amazing gags, but in an environment or surrounded by crew that is just absolutely not correct. And mm-hmm. all that crap is reflected in the bodywork of the car, the paintwork
of
the car.
Right.
And, and we'll have to replace a car in some cases 100% that looks fantastic. It's doing an amazing stunt. And
but
it does
now you
all
can match it,
stuff,
right?
And we match it to the point where nobody knows, nobody cares. I know there are 3D people that go like, we did that. It's all 3D. You know what I mean? Like, they can't say it was all 100% real. But they did do that exact stunt, and it looked exactly like that, and it was amazing, and we just matched it. We just helped it out by replacing a piece, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's about the reflections. Yeah.
Because the reflections were bad. Even if it is all CG car, it's a totally real stunt.
Right.
And it's a distinction that a lot of people can't make because they think a CG thing starts in the computer. There's no real reference. Someone just made it up.
Right.
Versus something where somebody goes out and they do this incredibly dangerous stunt, you know, but let's say the pyro doesn't go off quite right. And the stunt itself was done. It is real. It becomes, for lack of a better word, the previs of the animation that we match. And we have the guideline of the lighting and everything that we need to do to make it feel just as absolutely real as the stunt they did.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't take anything away from the stunt.
Now, do you think that the basic reason for doing that was a marketing thing, that they had to be able to do that because they want to talk about how it's all done practically and they don't necessarily want to talk, they want to move away from the whole idea of CG. Look, it's all practical, and sort of using that as a marketing thing and putting down anything CG? Or do you think that they did it because they think it'll look better? Because you can make CG look pretty darn good if you have the right talent behind it, right?
Well, we're going to get away from that question a little bit with my answer.
Okay.
And I apologize.
That's all right.
And this is a broader thing for me. And it's about filmmaking in general, I mm-hmm. think, in this day and age. Back in the day, and this wasn't that long ago, 10, 15, certainly 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Everybody on set got together and they looked through the camera and they looked at the framing and they made a bunch of plans
mm-hmm.
and they hoped to God the plans worked and that the lighting would hold and that the, you know, gate didn't have a hair in it and
yep.
whatever it was. And they made a bunch of decisions and they said action. And when it worked, they looked at the video tab of the dailies and they went, fantastic, we got it, move on.
Right.
Right? They made decisions that, not that they don't, that there are a lot of films that do, but when you're looking at a big blue screen or a big green screen and you're just, you know, you're getting a small actor with a fan on them to get some hair,
mm-hmm.
you kind of look at it and you go, yeah, that'll work. And right. then later on, it's like, you know what? I think it would be nice if the camera were actually on the other side and it was looking this way. And
right.
why don't we replace, you know, our barren landscape, put a bunch of trees in there? And, well, I don't really like that. Let's make it buildings and let's make it an aerial shot. And, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so
there's a delay in decision-making in a lot of ways.
A delay in decision-making.
Yeah.
And it leads to a lot of, you know, I don't want to say wasted work, but it's a hard way to make a movie if it's not a real plan and it's based on real things. And
mm-hmm.
that's one of the things that's great about, you know, certainly the Fast and Furious franchise, and the fact that they do all of these stunts is, even if we're going in and we're working with those stunts and, you know, augmenting them or changing the environment around them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
From day one, the editors can edit with something that is the right action and it's doing something. The dynamics are correct. You're not art department or, you know, art designing
yeah.
the dynamics that are going to affect an edit when you finally get the dynamics done right 3 months from now or whatever.
I think it's a fantastic point. I think you're absolutely right. And it shows that they know what they were doing, right?
Yeah,
they don't sort of sit there and delay the decision process. But do you think that there is a lot of, and I've mentioned this on several podcasts, but it's there's a lot of the villainization of CG, right?
Sure.
And I think that's a little sad sometimes because I think we do good work. And you know, the problem is, and this what Fate of Furious is a perfect example. It's so good you don't know which one is which. And so to their advantage, they'll say, it's all practical, but it's not necessarily all practical. And even if you did use the right reference, the fact is the reflections look so good in that car that's exactly the right movement that you can't tell that it's not the practical car in terms of reflection. So I don't think that it's necessarily fair that people get villainized to do that, right? And I think that CG deserves a little bit more respect in a lot of ways.
Well, I certainly would never disagree that that CG needs more respect. You know, some of that also just comes along because of the fact that we're so late to the party. You know what I mean? There have been, you know, caterers catering on film sets for 100 years. Sure. So clearly they're going to be above us in the, you know, in the scroll, you know,
Like,
or whatever it is. You know, we've come pretty late to the party, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think that also the fact is there's a lot of bad CG now because there's so much of it.
Sure.
So there's bad CG, and then the minute people see bad CG, it's like CG is bad. No, bad CG is bad. Good CG, you probably never even noticed it was there. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of that stuff. But anyway, I really, really think that what, you know, the Fate of Furious, which is the last thing that you're doing that we can talk about, is probably one of a great example of that. That's really good CG that it just looks awesome. Of course, there's some crazy ass stuff going on in there that just by concept of logic you would know it is not necessarily real. but still it's pretty cool. So what are some of your favorite parts of that movie? What's your favorite sequence?
Well, my favorite sequence, we did not do much work on. There was actually very little work done in this sequence, though we did have our hands in there in a few key places, is the scene with Jason Statham on the plane with the baby.
Really?
Oh my God. It makes me laugh out loud every time.
Right.
He is, first of all, a bona fide action star. I mean, that guy is just, you know, the stuff that he does and how quickly he can turn on a dime and flash a smile and make a joke and make everybody laugh. I was super impressed with that part. So, you know, when I see the movie, which I've seen it quite a few times, including paying my own hard-earned dollars to go see, that's the one that always makes me laugh.
Did you see him in the Melissa Murray Spy? Did you see him?
I haven't seen that yet. Oh, I do want to see that.
He's a parody of himself, which is awesome.
That's great.
It's so funny.
That's great.
So good. All right. Well, let's talk about some of the other fun stuff you're doing. And you were in commercials. Obviously, you worked on that Pontiac commercial. What are some of your other favorite commercials you worked about back in the day?
Oh, back in the day. God, there were a lot of them that were an absolute blast. I mean, there were two commercials I alluded to earlier that won best visual effects in a commercial.
Right.
In the VES. What were the years? 2009, 2010, something like that. I'm not 2008, 2009. I'm not entirely sure. The first one was one where I collaborated with Nikos, and it was a huge Houdini job. It was a Bacardi commercial.
The Bacardi commercial. Beautiful. Bacardi
commercial.
Beautiful.
Super, super fun commercial. And then that had, you know, we had an extensive round of working with choreographers and dancers to come up with a lot of moves. Joseph Kahn directed that. He did a great job with coming up with ideas of how these guys would all move and how they could, you know, blend together their actions. And then we had a mocap session where they performed all of these and then got all that data and, you know, played around with, you know, the idea behind the spot was, and I think we were pretty successful in it, is that you were watching one volume of fluid. You weren't just watching a bunch of different things happen. Mm-hmm. There was a conservation of fluid that actors would splash and fling liquid around, but ultimately the next set of actors would come out of all of that fluid doing something else. And, you know, you'd go from a close-up of a head from a girl that was doing a hair flip and water flying off. And as that splashed out, you know, four people came out of the center of that volume of water as liquid people dancing, doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that was super cool. That was very Houdini intensive to get all of our fluid sims and liquid working right, and really turned out well. Super happy with that. And then the following year, it was a commercial for Carl Eric Rinch for Audi.
Oh,
and
the
it was Audi Rubik's Cube spot with the car in the glass solving itself.
I love that one. That one is so cool. And I believe you guys did that in V-Ray, right? Yeah.
Yes.
But what I loved about it is it was so ray tracy. You know what I mean?
Oh, it was super ray tracy.
So like all the reflection, the refraction, the distortion, the everything. It was gorgeous, gorgeous commercial. Now, that was all CG, or was there some practical in there too?
There's one shot at the very end where we went to Germany and we shot a car on a turntable. So we set it up with studio lighting and we put it on a turntable.
Got it.
And it starts out as a profile because the last CG shot you see is a profile of the car inside the glass Rubik's cube. And then you cut back and, you know, CG environment and CG augmentations to the car, but was a real car on a turntable that turned towards us and then flashed its lights.
Nice.
So a very minor amount of practical in that. Mm-hmm. And I got a bunch of funny stories.
Okay.
About that one, actually. This is Norbson
worked
one.
On that too, right?
Yes, Norbson did work on that one. So the European commercials, and I'll probably get this wrong, and you know, don't sue me, anybody that works on European commercials. Mm-hmm. But it's the agency that really comes up with the idea, and also I believe floats some of the cash, and sometimes the production company floats some of the cash, and then they in turn sell it. It's like making something and then selling it to the client
more like so than it is. Almost?
Yeah, kind of. And you know, so they had originally had a very different plan for this spot.
Okay.
And the production company that Carl worked with, over in Germany, Marken Film, found out about this spot, but Carl was not one of the directors, I think, that was being considered at the time. But they heard glass Rubik's Cube and solve a car and thought, oh my God, that thing could be beautiful. And Carl could make this just absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to sell us as a team. And I got a call, hey, you know, can you be on a plane tomorrow and fly to Germany? I was on the ground less time in Germany than I was in the air flying there and back. Mm-hmm. And the director, I think, was in Morocco at the time or somewhere. And he was, we need you there tomorrow. Can you fly? And we're going to set up a meeting with this ad agency, and we're going to have a presentation. And I hadn't actually had any time to speak with Carl about it. It was jump on a plane and go. And I heard the brief and thought, wow, you know, glass Rubik's Cube, that'd be really cool. So we go into this meeting, relatively cold, and sit down and meet with the agency. And their point was, and I think it was, you know, beautifully conceived, is that you know, the technologies that exist out there, you know, everybody has a turbo diesel and everybody has direct fuel injection and everybody has, you know, whatever. It's not the sum of the parts. It's how they're combined. It's how they're put together that makes an Audi better than a Mercedes or a Volkswagen or whoever you're trying to sell Audis to. And they came up with this idea of, you know, you put a car in a Rubik's Cube and you mess up the Rubik's Cube. And as the Rubik's Cube gets more solved, the car becomes more car shaped as it goes. Mm-hmm. And Carl comes up there. He's, you know, this is, I think it's going to be beautiful. You know, the idea of the glass and the car and all this stuff is fantastic. But, you know, running a car through a bread slicer.
Right.
And then putting it in a bunch of glass boxes. And then, you know, pretty soon you put two halves of a hood that are each in different glass boxes next to each other. You know, do they magically seal? You know what I mean? Like, the people are going to know it's fake. They're going to know if you just are showing a sliced up car solve itself, you know, there's you know, no one's going to believe that it could have been real.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just kind of like, yeah, so? And he's like, he says, I propose we create a mechanism that assembles a car from its component parts. You break right. down into parts that it can only be broken down into. Mm-hmm. And then as you solve it, these pieces are delivered and assembled into you know, a car shape. And I'm on the other end of the table going, wow, that's actually really cool. You know what I mean? And they go, and you can do this? And he just points at the other end of the table at me and he goes, he can. I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I, you know, clearly, again, you know, it's I'm a dyed-in-the-wool car guy and, right. you know, I've taken apart engines and, yep. you know, done a bunch of stuff. So I very much understand how that stuff goes, but I wasn't prepared for that, you know, and, right. but just like when I got a call from the law firm said, hey, can you do, you know, mountains and landscapes, you know what I mean? They turned to me and said, really, you can do this? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sure. It's what we do. You know what I mean? We figure it out as we go along.
It's something I learned very quickly when I started, you know, when I was at first job at DD, was on Day After Tomorrow, and it was at Andy Whistler, and I was still like a deer in the headlights, but so excited, you know, like a puppy dog shaking his tail all the time, right? But I was suddenly they were giving some task and it was something I had never done before. I don't even remember what it was, but it was like, I went up to him and I said, somebody, he was a CG supervisor. Like, I don't know how to do that. And he goes, oh yeah, no one does. I don't know how to do that either, but I'm sure we can figure it out. And I was like, oh, okay. So it's okay to admit that you don't know how to do something? He's like, no one knows how to do anything. That's the whole point of visual effects. You're always doing something no one's been done before.
Always doing it. Always doing it. And it's so much fun to do that. You have to sell it differently when someone's asking you to do it. You know what I mean? When you don't know.
You have to
sell it.
We can do it.
In a different way. But yeah, no. So then we spent a lot of time. We actually, when I went back to do this shoot, we had unprecedented access granted to us by Audi. While we had one stage set up with the turntable to shoot the car, we had the stage next door with a full engine and transmission and a bunch of Audi techs going, what do you want to see?
Oh, so they were disassembling?
Oh, can you take apart the cylinder head so the, you know, and get the pistons out so I can get, you know, pictures of the connecting rods and the bulb? And, you know, and we had cameras set up and we were recording how they took everything apart. And they literally just took apart engines and transmissions and laid everything out on tables for us so that we could take photos of all this stuff. It was amazing. I was a car guy, you know, it was my dream to be there and have these guys, you know, just rip everything apart.
Right.
Like that. It was super cool.
I was at the, I was in Stuttgart for FMX. We had one of the dinners they had was at the Porsche Car Museum. It's like, oh, it's gorgeous.
I went through on a different job, also with Mark and Film. I got a chance to go through Stuttgart, but they were still building that museum.
Right.
That museum.
But you got to go to the assembly
plant. I got to go to the plant. Right. I got to go through see the assembly line and get the whole tour and the old museum, which was actually in the plant. Mm-hmm. I haven't been to the new big beautiful museum yet.
Yeah.
I really want to see it. It's gorgeous. On my bucket list.
Yeah, they had the old tractor there and all that stuff, the Porsche tractor. But I remember you had just bought a new Porsche. Was you're going to be your racing car? God, what was it?
During 47 Ronin.
I think that's right.
It was during 47 Ronin. Yeah, I ordered a 2012 Porsche Cayman R.
Mm-hmm.
That was my track car for a few years.
Right.
Still have it. I drove it here today.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? That's different. A lot of people buy sports cars and they just drive them around, you know, 30 miles an hour between stop signs. You don't. You race.
I bought that car specifically to be a track car.
Right. This is why I respect you so much. Is you and Daniel Buck. Daniel Buck takes his cars that are all-wheel drive cars and he drives the shit out of them, right?
Like
he
takes them up mountains, up mountains.
Right. And then you take your cars and you go through tires and race them around a lot. And you set several records with that car, right? And when you first got it.
When I first got it, for the class that I was running in with the Porsche Racing Club that I was involved in.
Right.
Ultimately, I got to the point with that car that I decided if I was going to continue on it needed to become a full race car. It was just not, you know, with a family and kid and right. everything else. I was, you know, racing at California Speedway and some of the bigger fast tracks, and mm-hmm. I just couldn't take the chance of having a bad accident with something that only had a, you know, 3-point seat belt and a airbag. Right. And I had an old Porsche 944.
Right, I remember that.
That I used to race. It was a 944 spec car. It wasn't street legal. Right. I have to tow it everywhere. And I stopped driving it because I just didn't have time to race it once I become a visual effects supervisor. And my son was born.
Yeah.
But I did find that I still had enough time to do track events mm-hmm. with the Cayman, and that car has a full roll cage, and it's got, you know, more safety equipment and nets and, you know, fire suppression system and all that kind of stuff. And it was just sitting in my garage. And I got it out and I took it to the track, and I felt like after driving a 330 horsepower brand new, you know, Porsche, it felt like I could get out and run faster.
Right.
You know, so I embarked on something that I've been working on now for almost 3 years, took the engine out of it, built a 944 turbo engine.
Really?
Yeah. I have to get it on the dyno, but I think it's going to, you know, be north of 300 horsepower to the wheels, replacing an engine that had 132 horsepower. To the wheels.
Wow.
And went through the suspension, took the front hubs off and put custom hubs and bearings on to allow me to put 13-inch Cayenne rotors, you know, the big Cayenne mm-hmm. SUV. I've got giant rotors with big black Brembo calipers
wow.
on it.
And things gonna break.
It's pretty cool. So I was hoping to have already had that done and had it on the road. But I love
the fact that you have that, you know, you like that. That's your thing that you like to do. I still like the fact that you had your when you got the new car and you strapped the wheel, your race wheels on the hood. So you have four wheels and you have four racing wheels that you had on the hood of the car, drive it to the track, take the wheels off, replace it with your street wheels, and then you start racing it. That was kind of awesome. Yeah, because you couldn't drive that on the street, your racing wheels. You wouldn't want to do that. Yeah.
No.
So, all right. You mentioned Carl Rensch, right? You did mm-hmm. several projects with him.
Mm-hmm.
Who's some of the other favorite directors you worked with?
David Fincher as a CG supervisor. I CG supervised, I think, his last commercial he did at DD for a number of years with Fred Raimondi, who was an Olympics spot.
Yes.
And then he came back a few years later to work with Eric Barba. And I did quite a few of those, and those were amazing. I mean,
yeah. What's your take on Fincher?
Yeah, I've never seen anybody with an eye like he has. You right. know what I mean? He is extremely specific mm-hmm. When he sees something. You know what I mean? Or when he shoots something, or what he knows is going to happen from when he shoots it to when he goes. You know, I made that whole talk earlier about, you know, it's so easy to just kind of, you know, point at a green screen and go, we'll figure this out later.
Yep.
I mean, that guy knows from the second he puts a camera up, you know what I mean? It's going to be this, and he'll tell you what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And you start doing something and he's like, if you remember, I said, it's going to be this. So don't show me that thing again. It's going to be, you know,
right.
And those were exceptionally well conceived.
You know, that's it.
Projects.
There was a video that came out, maybe it was last week or 2 weeks ago. I don't remember, but it was someone did a video outlining why David Fincher is one of the best directors, specifically when it comes to his use of CG or visual effects. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've, did you see that video? Mm-hmm. I'll show it to you after we finish recording. It's so well done and it's so brilliant. And there's several things that I know, you know, you worked on and I worked on David, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And what's the other one that we did at DD, the Zodiac Killer and all mm-hmm. that stuff. And it's specifically because he knows exactly how to use it. Now people's like, well, that's a little bit going too far, don't you think? I was like, no, because that's his vision, and his vision is clear, and it complements the story so well that mm-hmm. it's amazing. And I agree with you. I think he is he is very specific. I only worked on one thing with him. I only worked on Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, but I was really, really amazed. And yeah, I mean, sorry, but it's hard to compete with that, right?
Yeah, like, you know, there's, and there's different ways to work, and everybody has a different way to work. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's what ends up on screen. You know what I mean? Like not to, you know, call out any particular, you know, studios or franchises or whatever, mm-hmm. but there are certainly places that, you know, they everything's done by committee.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have 11 people in the room,
ugh.
You know, and the first one says, you know, I don't know, I think it should be more blue.
Right.
You know, and the other 10 people are like, nah, I don't know. I don't think it's too blue.
Well,
and
everyone feels like they have to have their thumb in the pie. That's the way Daniel used to say it, right? Like they all have to have, they have to say one comment just to make sure that they have value for the meeting, right?
Well, possibly.
Yes.
I would like to give
benefit of the doubt.
Sure. In this case, I'm going to give benefit of the doubt, you know, for the sense of the story.
Yeah.
You've got 11 people in a room and they all really care about the project and they really care about, you know, their particular comments. Let's say they're not making comments because they feel they need to make comments.
Right.
But you know what I mean? Like, you know, first person says, you know, I don't know, it's too blue. It can't be that blue. And the other 10 go, I don't know. I don't think it's too blue. And,
right.
And then the second guy or gal says, I don't know what you're talking about with too blue. It's too pink. I can't stand the pink that's in there.
Right.
You know? And the other 10 are like, well, I don't, the pink doesn't really bother me.
Right.
And then the third one's like, well, I just think we need to re-rack the shot up a little bit. I don't like the framing. And the other 10 go, no, the framing kind of fun. You get to a point where not one single person in that 10 is happy.
Right.
With the shot that's going up there, but they can't agree on the things that are wrong. They all agree that the thing that you don't like is not a big deal. And you know, shots will go out the door like that. Or they'll sit in limbo because nobody knows what to do. Or I mean, I'm not trying to take it away. There are groups of people that work so well together.
Right.
Or they've been doing this for so long or whatever that they come up with fantastic projects.
Well, that's okay.
That you want to kill yourself when you're working on them.
Well, let's bring that up because I think Fincher specifically famously works with the same people all the time. So he works with Eric Barb a lot. He works with Tim Miller as well. And, you know, he always uses Claudio for all of his shots, right? So he always does the same people because those, after a long time working together, they got a shorthand, right?
Sure.
So let's use your example of Too Pink, right? Eric said, that shot is too magenta, got to get that out of there. David can smell magenta from the parking lot, just get it out of there, right? So he knows the language that David Fincher is. And so to bring it back to my question, do you feel that, based on these directors you like to work like David, do you feel that after you've worked with him on your first movie, your second movie, or third movie, whatever it is, or commercial, do you feel that you've become a changed person from that process? And what are some of those changes do you feel? You know what I mean? Or do you, a better, like, do you, have you learned a lot? Like,
definitely. I definitely learned something from every single project.
Right.
Every single project, whether it was a good project or a bad project.
Sure.
Or, you know, I didn't sleep or see my family for 6 months.
Right.
Or it was a project that I went home every day at 5 because every day you came in and you showed something. They go, wow, this is great. What toys are we going to see tomorrow?
Right.
You know what I mean? Although those projects are few and far between.
Right.
I don't know about changed, but definitely I learned something from every single one. And you start to see patterns. You start to see, you know, well, this director or studio side visual effects supervisor or whoever it is that's your client, they're a combination of this person and that person. You know what I mean? Like you know, as you are coming up in this industry, everybody always has that that one person they've worked with or that mentor or whatever that has a very specific thing that they look for. And it's very funny because you find that the people that work with them a lot, they get that same, not necessarily idiosyncrasy, but you know, there's a project that I worked on that it didn't matter how many times we went into the Z-depth and made absolutely sure that the gradation of aerial perspective as it went back into the scene, like, you know, was exactly the numbers. You'd show it and every time, I just not buying the smoke levels and how it goes, blah, blah, blah. It's right. like, okay, you know what I mean? And clearly that person had their head beaten against the wall multiple times by somebody that just smoke levels have to be right. You have to have aerial perspective that goes back. This is what makes a shot.
Right.
And you know, that's going to be their thing. You know what I mean? And, and maybe it's a color palette for another director or, you know, Fast and Furious, has had multiple directors, for the last, couple of movies. But they do keep the same editors and the same studio side visual effects supervisor and a lot of the same people on set, you know, and the same second unit director. So, so, you know, there is a lot of
the language.
There's a lot of holdover from the previous films that once you know you're submitting things for final, you know, it's, you know, like I said, we had 800 shots for this one. It was 870 or something like that for Fast and Furious 7. You know, when I was delivering the 800th shot, it was really like I was delivering the 1600th shot because they all led up to the same thing. You know what I mean? You know, and that's what allows you to, when you get into something like that, to deliver hundreds of shots, not just the machine that you built, but this machine that you built knowing the kind of things that you're going to need to do or the hoops you're going to jump through at the end in order to get them to, you know, press that button.
Well, that totally makes sense. We're over an hour, but I want to make sure if there's anything that you want to talk about what's going on in the future, things to look forward to. I know you can't necessarily talk about projects too publicly, but if there's anything to look forward to that you can think of or...
You know what? No, not for me. I've taken a bunch of meetings since finishing Fast. And, you know, some of these projects are still out there in limbo. So I don't know exactly what my next step is going to be, which has been great because I've been able to take a couple of days off here and there and work on the race car. Which I've done. And I'll share some pictures with you afterwards because that one's really fun. But, you know, it's a good thing because we're really busy right now. I mean, we have every available person. You know, if all of a sudden I needed to put a team together, it would be hard. I wouldn't have anybody to grab from because our office is extremely busy right now.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's great. Well, we'll look forward to a lot of the great work. And I'll thank you, Tiffany, for letting Jay come over. But we'll have some other people from DD come by, some of the old school guys. Hopefully Darren will come by. I'd like to talk to him. How's he doing? He's doing all right?
Yeah, he's doing very well.
Has he lost his South African accent?
No. No, not at all. I have no idea if or when he'll be able to talk about what he's currently working on, but it is amazing.
Really?
It is super cool. So,
all right. Well, you know who does a fantastic impression, of course, as you can imagine, of Darren Handler? It's Lou.
Well, Lou does a great impression of everybody.
Does an impression of me sometimes, my laugh, of course. And yeah, that's pretty funny. Anyway, thanks so much, Jay. I really appreciate you coming by. And I got a couple things to show you, but I don't know. We'll see you. Are you going to come to SIGGRAPH, you think? You don't know? Walk around?
It depends on what happens in the next
of course.
Little bit. You know, something could land and, you know, I'm off shooting.
There you go. That's the fate of the world. All right. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.